feel like I'm hiding behind it. I don't know. Well, friends, if you're new around here, my name's Tim, and we've been working our way through the book of Galatians. And as you can see, the graphic we're using for this series is, we've called the series Free, because the main theme that comes out of this letter of Galatians is to do with Christian freedom. And look, the first verse that you read there in chapter 5 in Galatians there, read it with me. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. I'm going to talk about freedom today. And really, friends, why we gather week in, week out is because we are a people who have been gathered by God. But as we gather together, I trust that one of the big things that we're wanting to understand is our freedom. We wanted to dig into it, and we're wanting to understand in such a way that we'd enjoy it, we'd experience our freedom, we'd live in our freedom, we'd celebrate our freedom. That is our pursuit together. And now, if you're kind of new to these things, it may be that you're here thinking, you're trying to suss out, really, why do these things happen? Why do these people gather for church? Is it that they feel like they have to? Is it that they're just trying to figure out what all the rules are and tick the boxes? No, we understand ourselves to be people who Christ has set free, and we want to celebrate that freedom. That's what we're doing week in, week out. This is who we are. It's interesting words, though, isn't it, that Paul uses there in verse 1 when he starts to talk about freedom. Look at the verse with me. It says, it is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Which is to say this, Christ came to set us free so that we would be free. It's like, it's kind of like Captain Obvious, isn't it? Like, Jesus came to set you free so that you would be free. But let's just hear the emphasis that Paul wants us to get here. God came to us in the person of the Son to set us free so that we would experience freedom, that we'd really understand it and we'd really live in it and you would experience it. So the question I really want to ask this morning is, are you experiencing freedom in Christ? Do you understand the nature of the freedom that Christ has come to win for you, and are you living in it? They're the two things I want to ask this morning, because we're meant to enjoy our freedom. And one of the ways to enjoy your freedom is to make sure you avoid the things that are actually going to threaten your freedom, and you run from the things that are actually going to ruin your freedom. And friends, if there's any passage that's going to help us understand that, it's this one, Galatians chapter 5, because it's going to tell us about what our freedom is, and it's going to tell us about two key things that threaten our freedom. Two key things that actually will ruin our freedom. And Paul is speaking here to the Galatians, and he's concerned for them because they are drifting into one of two of these things that are different forms of slavery. They're being tricked into going back there. Paul writes a very impassioned letter here because he's very concerned for their freedom. He's concerned that after being people who have been set free, they're now running back into slavery. So look at verse 1. It is for freedom that Christ has set you free. So stand firm. Do not let yourselves be burdened again by the yoke of slavery. That makes sense. And Paul's saying, listen, Christ has set you free. So stay in your freedom. Be very careful you're not wandering off back into slavery again, which is exactly what's happening for them. It's entirely possible to be to someone who actually gets the grace of Christ, but then over time, for different reasons, people impacting your life, obstacles in your life, a whole bunch of dynamics, you've wandered or been bumped off the track of freedom into the ditch of slavery again. The ditch of slavery that Christ came to rescue you from. So the two things we're going to see this morning is the two common forms of slavery, or the two things that easily ruin our experience of freedom as Christians, the two areas we easily drift back into. And the way we're going to think about it this morning is by thinking about it with a picture in mind. And Paul gives us the picture. In fact, Paul's really good with that in his letters. He often gives little illustrations or diagrams, pictures to help us understand these theological concepts. And he gives it to us there in verse 7. Have a look at the picture that he uses to describe Christians being free. Verse 7, you were running a good race. Who cut in on you and kept you from obeying the truth? So Paul's saying, to be set free by Christ and to be living in the grace of Christ is to be like running a good race. So picture someone running a race. Picture yourself as a Christian running the good race. And picture this even more, running a good race on a particular kind of track or path. And I want to call it the freedom path this morning. Now, I tried drawing this on my whiteboard. You know, occasionally I've brought to you really dodgy whiteboard drawings. Have you remembered them of those? I tried drawing this on my whiteboard and it was so bad I couldn't bring it to you because it wouldn't have helped at all. So I think what you're going to find most helpful is to just picture what I'm describing here and use this to kind of hang the theological ideas on, okay? So picture this. There's a path or a track. It's not a highway, it's a track. And it's the freedom path or the freedom track. The person running on that track is the person who's been set free by Christ, a person who's living in the grace of Christ. But either side of the track is a ditch. And these are the two ditches that we have a tendency to wobble off and fall into. And these are the two common forms of slavery for the Christian. And the problem is that we're being told here is that on the freedom path, on the freedom track are obstacles. And they might come in the form of people or experiences in life. For the Galatians, it came in the form of people who brought a different kind of teaching. And this obstacle that came on the freedom path for them caused them to be bumped off from running the good race, and they found themselves in the ditch of slavery again. And Paul is stressed for them, concerned for them that they'd get back on the freedom path. So can you picture that? It's a pretty simple picture, isn't it? There's a path, there's a ditch on either side, two different forms of slavery, and the two different temptations for Christians to wobble off into. And there might be one of the ditches this morning that you understand yourself to be have a tendency to go toward more than the other one, or they might both be equal tendencies for you. Our task this morning is to think about the freedom path. What is the nature of running running in the freedom of Christ? What does that look like? And what are the two things we need to be careful to avoid? What are the two things that are actually going to ruin our experience of freedom that Christ came to win for us? And how can we avoid them? So you got that picture in your mind? Yeah? Just give me a nod, someone. Nod. There you go. There it is. The first ditch, the ditch on the left. Well, my left, your right. I want to call the ditch of legalism. Yeah? It's a form of slavery. Legalism. And I want to use that word, and some of you have heard these words before. Legalism really is to talk about a person who drifts towards being legalistic in their life, meaning they're someone who loves the law, they love a code, they love a list of rules, and they love that that is the way you find yourself right with God. You have this list of things like a law, and if you can tick all the boxes, then you're right with God. Now, the kind of person that easily drifts towards legalism, which is a form of slavery, and it means you're if you drift that way, it will ruin your freedom and your salvation, is someone who thinks this, and we all might, to a certain degree, be tempted to think like this. In regards to your salvation, you think, well, it can't all be a gift of grace. It just sounds too easy that God would do it all for me. Surely there's something that I contribute to my salvation. And I like the idea that I do contribute to my salvation. And so perhaps it's like this. Jesus does the work of the cross, and then I do my things, and then together those things combine to win salvation. Okay? That's not the gospel, but that's what we easily drift towards, and I want to call that legalism. And it looks something like this, and here's what the Galatians have drifted towards. Trusting in Jesus plus becoming a Jew. Or we might just say, trusting in Jesus plus something I do. And so there's Jesus' contribution and my contribution. But the problem is, and we've talked about this week in, week out, because Paul is just continues to talk about it, if you add anything to the grace of Christ, his work of the cross, you add anything to it, you destroy grace. You add anything to Jesus, you lose Jesus. So the equation goes like this, if you want to put it in a mathematical equation. It's not that complex, but it's kind of strange. The equation goes like this. Jesus' work of the cross plus your work that you contribute equals just your work that you contribute, because Jesus' work is destroyed. Add anything to grace, you lose Jesus, and what you're left with is just you by your own efforts and your own performance trying to earn acceptance and approval by God. Legalism, thinking you earn, it all boils down to, I find myself right with God by a law or some kind of code, which is effectively what the Bible would call self-righteousness. You make yourself righteous by obeying, and some will drift towards a religious kind of law. Others will just really live by a moral law, a law that's been passed down to them through their family. Here's what a good person is. And you've got it in your heart and you've got it in your head. And you're thinking, if I just live according to these things, I'll be a good enough person and surely God will accept me. That's legalism. It's attempting to justify yourself before God by obedience to a law. It's described perfectly there in verse 4 by Paul. This is what the Galatians have drifted towards doing. They've drifted into the ditch of legalism. Look at it. Verse 4. You who are trying to be justified by the law. The word justified means made right with God. So they are trying to make themselves right with God by law, by religious law. So the legalistic person is trying to earn acceptance with God by some kind of code, by personal performance. But the problem is, it's not just a funny way to do it. It actually just doesn't work at all. You read on in verse 4, you who are trying to be justified by the law have been alienated from Christ. You've fallen away from grace. So it doesn't work at all. It does the exact opposite of moving you towards being a place where you're accepted by God. It means you're alienated from Him, separated from Him. You try to perform your way into heaven, you'll find yourself more and more distant from God. Because it doesn't work. You can't do it. He says you've fallen away from grace. You were living in the grace of Christ and now you're trying to earn it for yourself. You've fallen off the path. And this is the tragedy of the Galatian situation here. They're on the freedom path, but they've slipped into that ditch. There's only one way to find yourself right with God, and Paul keeps speaking about it time and time again. Here it is in verse 5 for us again. Here's how you find yourself right with God. For through the Spirit we eagerly await by faith the righteousness for which we hope. You want to find yourself right with God? You want that righteousness? It is by faith. It's by a simple trust in Jesus' performance, His life and death on the cross, which is in your place and is offered to you by faith. And you receive it as a gift of grace from Him. It's a righteousness that comes to you now and puts you right with God. And it's a righteousness that we await as well by the Spirit. The Spirit is the one that lives in us, enabling us to continue to trust and have faith in Jesus' righteousness, knowing that we're right with God now, and there will be a day, the final day of judgment, where the fulfillment of our righteousness will be apparent to everyone. So we await for that day. And if that's the case, if that's how a person can find themselves right with God and there's no other way, then law, legalism, code, rules is of no value insofar as making yourself right with God. I'm aware at the moment that our EV kids and our EV youth are working through Galatians as well, so I'm always asking my kids how they're understanding these things. And my kids come home with great understanding of these things because the talks they're getting in EV kids and EV youth are just phenomenal. Evie came home the other day, 2 weeks ago, and she said, yeah, here's how it is, Dad. I'm like, good, preach it to me, sister. She's like 12 or something. She's like, you don't get saved because you obey. You obey because you're saved. All right? You've got to get the order right. It's so important to get the order right. There is obedience that we're called to as Christians, but that is not what saves us. Living a life to honor God does not save you. We're saved by faith, and from that place of being right with God, then we push on into this life with gratitude and thanksgiving, wanting to honor Him because of everything that He's done. The order is so important. Problem is, we so often drift after having understood that we're saved by faith and we press on into this life. We start to think we're doing well. We start to think everyone else is impressed by this wonderful life we're living. You know, people around you got your respect and you start drifting towards thinking, therefore God must be pretty impressed with how I'm living. And you start drifting towards thinking that that is the basis on which you're accepted is your own performance. You're drifting into the ditch. The ditch is legalism. And Paul just wants us to know, he wants them to know, really, law, rules, obedience to things doesn't matter. It doesn't do anything to get you right with God. But it's interesting the way he puts it there in verse 6. He doesn't say law is of no value. Look what he says in verse 6. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. Now, instead of saying law has no value, he says circumcision or uncircumcision has no value. So we need to talk about circumcision. If you've been working with us through the book of Galatians, you'll notice, if you've been reading it, this concept of circumcision just keeps coming up over and over and over again. And so even in this passage we're looking at here, I think it comes up 6 times. So it's the kind of thing you could just brush over. Actually, the whole of the New Testament, you could just ignore it and pretend like the concept's not there. Or you could try to understand it and therefore find it helpful. Now, some of you I know have been sitting there through this series and reading this and just thinking, oh my goodness, what is with this deal about circumcision that just keeps coming up? It's a little bit awkward to hear about it in church. It's a little bit awkward to read about it in the Bible. Some of you understand the significance and you're like, yep, good, got it, great. Others of you are sitting there thinking, am I the only one thinking this is weird to be hearing about circumcision in church and reading about it all the time? And you're sitting there thinking, is it really talking about what I'm thinking it's talking about? Yes, it is. It is. So circumcision is, technically speaking, let me make sure I choose my words correctly here and not offend anyone. Circumcision is the removal of the foreskin from the male genitalia. That's put technically, isn't it? No one's feeling offended. But, you know, in case you don't get that, I've got a few slides for you, diagrams to tell you. Nah, I'm just joking. All right. But that would have been good, wouldn't it? No. But what's the deal? Like, so we understand the concept. Well, why does it keep coming up? Why is it in the Bible? What's the big deal? Why does Paul keep talking about it over and over again? What's it got to do with anything? What's the significance? Well, the reason why I wanted the reading from Genesis chapter 17 is because that is where we see circumcision first being, the idea of circumcision first being given to God's people. Circumcision was a practice that was widely done in the ancient world for lots of different reasons. Some cultures had it for men who would come of age at a certain age, or some just before they got married, which this is completely bizarre. It was for different reasons, but God actually gave it to his people to be practiced for a particular reason. And at the age of 8 days old, a young male Israelite would be circumcised. We read in Genesis chapter 17 when it was given, and let me just, rather than going back there, I'll just give you generally how it comes. We found out a couple of weeks ago that God first gives his promise of salvation and blessing to Abram back in Genesis chapter 12. He takes this pagan camel herder and says to him, I'm going to do something wonderful for the world through you. I'm actually going to bring salvation to humanity through you. I'm going to make a people out of you, even though you're really old. And I'm actually going to bless you and turn you into a nation. And through you, bring blessing to all nations. In other words, I'm going to bring my plan of salvation for humanity through you. And he makes this promise to Abraham in chapter 12. And it's a promise that he then renews again in chapter 15 of Genesis. And then he renews the promise again in chapter 17. I'm going to bring blessing. It's the promise of grace, God's promise of how he's going to bring salvation. And when he renews his promise in chapter 17, that is where you see the introduction of this concept of circumcision being given to God's people. And here's why it comes. God gives the practice of circumcision to God's people basically to say, wear this as a sign that you are people of the promise, that you're people who belong to me, you are people who are consecrated to me, you're holy to me. You know, wear this concept of circumcision, your males wear it as a badge that you are identified with me, Yahweh, the God who's made a promise of grace, of an incredible work I'm going to do through you. And it's almost similar to like a wedding ring. It wasn't given to them so that it would change them in any way. It was just given to them as a symbol or a sign of something that they were now caught up in, a covenant that they were part of, a promise that they were part of. The same way, like when I say wedding ring, putting on a wedding ring isn't what makes you a married person. No. What makes you a married person is the pledges, the promises, the covenant you make with a person, after which you then put on the ring as a symbol of the fact that you are now part of this promise, part of this covenant. Same thing with circumcision. They were to wear the badge of circumcision as a nation to say, yeah, they're part of this promise, swept up by this God, part of this covenant. And it was a permanent kind of sign or badge that they were to wear. And basically, here was the badge. The badge of circumcision was given to say that they were a people who were under God's promise, a people under promise, the promise of grace. That's why the badge of circumcision was given. But here's what happens over time. The badge, the significance of the badge, drifts. and it drifts for them. It was initially given, wear this as a sign that you are people under the promise, but it drifts over time. After the Mosaic law comes in, it drifts and they begin to wear circumcision as a badge that identifies them as people now who are under law. So the significance of the badge drifts over time. It's not why it was first given, but now you've got all these Jewish people getting circumcised as a badge or a sign or a way of identifying themselves as people who are under law. And when I say under law, people who are trying to get themselves right with God by obedience to a law. So the significance of the badge drifts over time. And this is exactly the situation for the Galatians. They are now people who, think about the Galatians, they're Gentiles, so not Jews by birth, so uncircumcised. That they come to hear about the grace of Christ and they come to be set free and they have salvation. And then these Jews come into town and say, oh, no, what you need to add to what you've got is you also now need to become a Jew, so you need to be circumcised and you need to do that because as a sign that you're under law. And Paul's saying, no. No, no, don't do that. Don't now bring yourself under law and see that as a way of making yourself right with God. Now, can you see the badge of circumcision is worn by people who are trying to say, we're trying to make ourselves right with God by obedience to a law. And so when Paul talks about circumcision, really he's talking about that concept, righteous by legalism to a law. And with that in mind, you come and now read verses 2 and 3 with me again. I trust it might make more sense for some of you. Or have more clarity. Paul says, mark my words. I, Paul, he doesn't want to mess with his words here. I, Paul, tell you that if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ is of no value to you at all. In other words, if you let yourself come under law and be a person who's trying to be right with God by obedience to a set of rules, Christ is of no value to you. Earlier, he says, basically, Jesus died for nothing, if that's how you're now trying to make yourself right with God. It's very clear. Look at verse 3. He says, again, I declare to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obligated to obey the whole law. You've got to keep the whole thing. You're going to try to be right with me by obedience to the law. You better keep the whole thing. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Problem is, no one can. And so Paul is trying to warn them about being circumcised as a sign that they come under law. Does that make sense? Paul is so concerned for them that they would drift from their freedom back into slavery that he actually even targets the people who have brought this new message of you need to be a Jew, you need to come under law, and he speaks very clearly about what he thinks about them. And you pick that up in verses 8, 9, 10, and 11. So just look at those briefly with me. Paul says, I'm confident in the Lord that you will... Verse 8, the kind of persuasion does not come from the one who calls you. In other words, these people who have brought this new message, what they're bringing, the persuasion they're bringing, it's not from God. It's not God's truth. It's lies. Don't believe it. Verse 9, Paul uses a phrase that Jesus often used. He says, a little yeast works through the whole batch of dough. And the concept is something small impacts the whole thing. So yeast makes the whole batch of dough rise. And Jesus uses that phrase all the time to talk about the yeast of the Pharisees, the teaching of the Jews, then actually just be a small tweak that changes the whole thing. So you might see this, they might be tempted to see this thing of like, oh yeah, add a little bit of works to what Christ has done. It's just being a small thing. Jesus says, no, it wrecks everything. So don't think you add something to contribute to your own salvation. Paul's confident, verse 10, that they will listen to his correction and come back. And then he speaks about the people who have brought this teaching again. Verse 11, they will pay. They will be punished for what they've brought in. This is very serious. Like he says in chapter 1, let them be eternally condemned. Let them be anathema. And here in verse 12, he doesn't mix his words at all. He says, as for those agitators, I wish they'd go the whole way and emasculate themselves. So I wish they'd slip with the knife altogether and actually take the whole lot off, make themselves eunuchs, which is just very, very strong words. He's obviously fired up about this. And at the heart of it, he's fired up and concerned that these people who had been set free by Jesus have wandered off into the ditch of slavery again. Legalism, trying to be right with God by your own performance and law keeping. So friend, let's us hear this warning about the ditch. We need to hear the warning that you don't get right with God by the same way you usually find yourself right with people. Yeah? Usually by living a certain way, you get the respect of people around you. And if you behave and you do certain things, you will gain the acceptance of people around you in the work environment, in your community environment. And it's entirely possible to live in such a good way as an upright person and a good person that you do end up having the respect of everyone around you. Please don't be confused with thinking that if you're right with people around you, therefore you must be right with God too. If you've got the respect of people around you, then you therefore must have the respect. Or if you're impressing the people around you, therefore God must be impressed. That's not how you get accepted by God. It's not the same way. It's completely different. Legalistic people usually have this kind of character. In their heart, they believe they can be good enough. They usually have a list of boxes that they're just ticking, and they feel like they're ticking most of their boxes. I'm getting it right. You legalistic people usually avoid big sins, the big kind of public sins, but overlook and justify lots of little sins, acceptable sins, they might call them. But legalistic people, because they think that they're not doing all the big bad ones, they feel proud about themselves and they look down on others and gossip about others in Christian ways. That sounds very nice. Or have you heard about Watsy? We really should pray for her. She's blah, 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 blah. Yeah? Because I feel so proud about how I am. Legalistic people nitpick at others. Legalistic people are usually pretty grumpy. Usually got frowns on their faces. They look down their nose. They're overly critical of everyone else all the time. They're self-righteous and they're annoying. Legalistic people are flat out annoying because they think they're so right and everyone else is so wrong. Their hearts are far from God. They're not joyful in God because they don't understand grace. They think they're doing it themselves. The only time a legalistic person will be joyful is where they feel like they're doing really well and everyone around them looks like they're doing poorly, and then they'll feel wonderful about themselves. Legalistic people whinge a lot. Is this your tendency to drift towards becoming that kind of person who believes you perform so well and compared to everyone else around you, and you're harsh and overly critical and annoying, really? Is that your tendency to drift that way? Friends, avoid that ditch. Avoid that form of slavery. It doesn't make you right with God. It actually is just something that's going to attack your freedom. So there's one ditch, the ditch of legalism. On the other side of the path, we have the ditch of what I want to call license. Okay? And now these are technical terms, you may have heard them elsewhere. License simply means this: a person who drifts towards licentiousness or feeling like they have a license to do whatever they want to do with their life. I'll live however I want to live. I'll do whatever I want to do, anything that I feel like is going to make me happy. So license really is feeling like you have the permission to be selfish with your life and just pursue things that just make you feel good. And actually, that is the common view of freedom, actually. The popular view of freedom in our society is a person is truly free when you do whatever you want to do with your life. But it's actually a form of slavery to actually live that way. The Christian kind of error that can cause a person to drift into licentiousness or license is this: a person who comes to understand grace and forgiveness and sees that God is the one who's forgiven me for everything I've done in the past and everything I'm doing right now and everything I'll do in the future, so yee-haw, I'm just going to enjoy my life. It doesn't really matter how I live if God's going to forgive me for anything. Problem is, God's grace is not a license for sin. You know? God didn't come to set you free so that you would sin. Look at verse 13. You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. There's how a Christian who can understand grace and freedom can drift towards indulgence of flesh. Now, when the Bible uses the word flesh, and it uses the word flesh a fair bit, actually. It's not talking about meat, like the actual substance of your body. When the Bible uses the word flesh, it's talking about your natural bodily desires and urges and instincts as a fallen person, as a broken person, just the desires that well up out of your heart and your head, the wants of your mind, which is really to focus on the willful selfishness that just actually will spring from your heart. Even if you are a Christian and you have a regenerate heart and God is changing you and sanctifying you, there still remains in you a brokenness and a sinfulness, which means from your heart will come desires which are actually entirely selfish and not good in any way. And to be told that we're not to indulge in the flesh tells us that the desires that come from the flesh are not all good. They can be good, but they're not all good. This is something we need to face about ourselves in regards to sin, which the Bible continually puts before us, which is a huge blow to our ego. Sin is not just the bad things we do sometimes or the good things we forget to do other times. Sin is our very broken nature. So that by nature, we will want to do things that are wrong. Sin is really a way of describing a heart condition of brokenness. That means, and I would say this of myself, I need to live with a healthy distrust of my own heart. I need to make sure that I don't just simply follow my heart, you know, which we get told to do all these days, you know. The biggest advice that gets put to people, just follow your heart, go with your gut. Well, like, your heart's broken and your gut's busted, so don't simply do that with your life. We tend to like to think of ourselves that we're essentially good, and we sometimes do bad things. I'm essentially good, I sometimes do bad things. The Bible would say, no. You're fundamentally broken, and sometimes you still do good things. Yeah? Essentially broken, sinful, but still with the capacity to do good things. And friends, if this is true, then we need to have a healthy distrust of ourselves. And whatever we do, make sure you don't simply just do whatever you feel like doing. Don't simply follow the desires of your heart. It's not freedom at all. It's actually a horrible form of slavery to obey the desires that come from your flesh. Paul actually says it's going to lead to destruction for you and those around you. If you simply obey the desires of the flesh, the main desire that will come from your flesh is willful selfishness, which is to focus on yourself. And if we all live like that and feel permission to just live like that, things are going to get ugly continually. And that's what's happening for them here. Look at verse 15. It says, if you bite and devour each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. See, if I'm living primarily for myself, then I'm going to tell you, sometimes you're going to get in my way. You know, you're going to come across, you're going to limit my ability to pursue my own happiness and live for myself. So I'm going to be frustrated at you. And if you're primarily living for yourself, then I'm going to frustrate you because I'm going to get in your way sometimes and I'm going to limit your ability to pursue your own happiness and self-indulgence. And so that's the problem that's going to be among us. Freedom is actually to avoid indulging in self. Freedom is to avoid the ditch of willful self-centeredness. I always laugh at kids because kids don't really have the capacity to cover up self-centeredness. Adults do. We develop kind of social appropriate ways as adults to pretend we're not so selfish. We really are. Kids don't have that. So kids are just out there just, you know, so one of the first words kids will learn is mine, yeah? And they'll just, I was joking with my cousin about this a couple of nights ago about kids, and he said he was sitting at the breakfast bar with his three daughters sitting in front of him. He was trying to serve out ice cream. Three daughters, three bowls, and a lot of stress about who's going to get more ice cream than the other one, right? And a lack of ability to kind of cover up the stress of self-centeredness and concern that I'm going to miss out, yeah? It's not fair, Dad. So he could just see this bubbling up in them. So he said, right, no one says anything. Just don't say anything. And he's there with the ice cream and he's serving it out into the bowls and he's kind of looking at them and he can just see them just freaking out, right? And one of them just couldn't hold it in any longer. She couldn't hold it in any longer. She was just like, me. That's what came out of her mouth. It was just me. And we just laughed and laughed and laughed because, you know, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. kids just go, me. Like, we're born broken and just so concerned for self. We learn to cover it up as adults, but it will be our constant battle to just not indulge in self, because that's what comes from our flesh. That's what comes from our brokenness, is concern primarily for self. But friends, it's a ditch of slavery. It'll ruin your freedom to actually indulge in yourself and the desires that come from your heart. The path of freedom, which is what we want to talk about now, is the very opposite of that. It's the opposite of self-centeredness. It's other person-centeredness. And the path of freedom is not what our society thinks freedom is. It's not what we would naturally consider freedom to be. The freedom that Christ has come to win for us is of a nature that we need to continually reflect on and lean into and understand again and again and again, because it doesn't come naturally to us. But it is true freedom. And it's a path. So let's think about the freedom path. Paul actually says here, it's like running a good race. And he says, someone cut in on you, he says to the Galatians, and kept you from obeying the truth. So really true freedom is to run the good race and obey truth. So freedom has boundaries. Freedom has a path to stick to. Freedom is not just about doing whatever you want. Freedom is actually having... Again, my daughter came home the other night from youth and she said, oh yeah, the fellow who's doing the talk said it's like this. Like, you look at a... I trust you'll enjoy these illustrations as well. It's like a fish in a bowl swimming. When is a fish truly free? It might look through the bowl out at the wonderful world outside and think, I'll be truly free if I can get out of this bowl. But a fish gets out of the fish bowl and it's dead. You know, it's slave to the air and it's going to kill it. A fish is truly free when it is inside the restraints and restrictions of the bowl. A fish is truly free when it remains in the place it was designed to live. And friends, the same is true for you and I. We are designed to live in a particular place. We are designed to operate in a particular way. We are designed to have boundaries that our God gives to us. We are designed to have a place where we run and stay, and when we're there, we'll be truly free. And so Paul says, it's like running a race. Stay on track, then you'll be free. He goes on, and we're going to look at this more next week. He says, a truly free person who is a person who, verse 16, walks by the Spirit. That's what it means to be free. You walk, verse 25 would say, in step with the Spirit. Which means you're very careful about the way you walk. You're very considered. That's what a free person does. Very considered in the way that they live. Verse 6, I would say, for us, is the way this passage helps us understand Christian freedom, and it's wonderful. Have a look at verse 6. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. There's the freedom path. Faith expressing itself through love. Faith and love. And friends, these two things are the very things that are going to help us avoid the ditches. You see, faith will keep you from legalism. Love will keep you from license. So these are the two key dynamics of the path of freedom. Let me just dig into that. These will keep us from the ditches. Faith will keep you from legalism, because faith is simply the belief that we are to remain in. The trust that we're to keep, and that trust is a trust in the performance of Jesus, a trust in his life on my behalf that is sufficient to make me right with God. And to hold to that faith and keep that faith will help you avoid the ditch of legalism, which is drifting towards thinking you put yourself right with God by your own performance. Verse 4 tells us that it's actually faith that will actually keep us on the grace track. And a couple of weeks ago, I put to you the concept of being people who continually come back to grace, come back to grace, come back to the promise of grace. It's the way God operates with us. The way you come back to grace is continually coming back to faith. Because the way you get to grace is through faith. It's the instrument through which grace comes. So come back to faith over and over and over again. Remain in the faith. Continually put your trust in Jesus, and that will keep you from the ditch of legalism. We live by faith. a simple trust in Jesus. And it's a faith, here's the second thing, that expresses itself in love. The primary expression, the primary display of genuine Christian faith is love. Now, everyone in our society likes the concept of love, but there is a love that is unique to Christianity, that is a love that's modeled to us by our God. It is a love of other person-centeredness, a love that is sacrificial. The way God shows us what love is he comes to us and gives himself for us, lays his life down that we would live. Friends, that is love. And if you get faith and you remain in faith, then the primary expression will be love, which is you laying your life down for others. You serving others and being other person-centered. The way Paul describes it there in verse 13 is he says, let's read 13 and 14. 13, you, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free. Do not use your freedom to indulge in the flesh. Rather, and here's love, here's freedom. Rather, serve one another humbly in love. There's love. There's Christian love. Serve one another humbly in love. Be focused on those around you, honoring them, serving them, laying your life down for them, thinking first and foremost about them. Verse 14 gives us the command. So the entire law, this is the law of the law that God has given, is now fulfilled in Christ. But look at it. The entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command. This is the law of Christ, if you might call it that. Love your neighbor as yourself. Which is not a command to love yourself. Notice how easily you do love yourself and are concerned for yourself and easily focused on yourself. Now understand that dynamic and in that same kind of focus, head towards the other person. Love your neighbor just like you easily love yourself. Love them. Focus on them. Serve them. Lay your life down for them. And as you think about loving those around you, that is the very thing that will keep you from the ditch of license. Because instead of being focused on yourself and just wanting to do all your own things, you're focused on other people. And you're not self-centered, you're focused on God and loving him. Friends, other person-centeredness will hold you back from just indulging yourself. And this is where true freedom can be found, in faith and in love. These are the restrictions or the boundaries of the path of freedom. And that is what we're called to live in, and that is the security. It will bring incredible security for us, running the good race. I'm going to leave it there, and I'll pray for us. Father God, we thank you for your word to us. We thank you so much to hear that you've come to set us free. Lord, help us understand that freedom, the really unique nature of true freedom. Help us understand the things that threaten that freedom, the slavery and the ditch of license and legalism. Help us to understand which one we naturally tend to head towards. Help us be warned. Help us, by the power of your Spirit, stay on the freedom track and pursue you in faith and in love, enjoying the security of our freedom in you. Amen.